Well, welcome back. Yeah, this is Yahoo's with microphone again on disc 2 of 2 Towers Extended Edition.
That was
actually a very good comedic moment. Yeah, it was. The scale double for Gimli twists his knee on that stunt, I think.
Falling off course. I imagine hurts.
Yeah.
No matter how you do it.
Now this is all added footage, is it not?
Yeah. The whole dialogue between that Theoden says to Aragorn.
I love finding out that Aragorn and Theoden have a backstory together.
Yeah, and I remember when, after you watched this, you sent me an email with the title. It's like, holy, what was
holy
it? Like,
crap,
holy crap, he's 87 years old. But it's something because of the fact that he is one of the Numenorean
Dunedain.
Yeah, he's...
Is this extended footage right here?
Yeah.
It is.
And I remember hearing on the commentary how Miranda Otto was really glad that this was cut from the theatrical version. Can't get out of it, Viggo. Gotta go for it.
I think they show, like, Gimli smelling the pot beforehand, or is it right after, or something like that, and, like, walking away from it, shaking his head, something like that.
Well, there is a little bit coming up. When, after this little bit of dialogue, I think you're right.
I find this, you know, it is a little kind of, I can see exactly why Miranda Otto was glad this scene was left on the cutting room floor, so to speak, but, I mean, because it does kind of like, she didn't want to be more action-oriented and she wanted to have more to do with part of the story.
Well, I think part of it was she just didn't want the character to seem as stereotypical as she does in this. Right. You know, the idea of, you know, maiden who's, you know, just supposed to make food for the men and all that stuff. I mean, you know, she is a very unique character, especially when you read the book.
Exactly.
And it pays off beautifully in Return of the King.
I like how she just stands there to, like, wait for it.
Yeah.
You know? Now, why don't I believe in this love story as much as I do the Aragorn and...
Eowyn?
Eowyn's. I mean, just...
Because of the fact... I think it's because of the fact that... And the writers acknowledge it. It's not a conventional love story. You don't have the conventional arc of boy meets girl, boy falls in love with girl, boy, you know, boy loses girl, and all of that stuff. I mean, that stuff has already happened. And this, I think, it's an unconventional love story, this is true, in the fact that it's really all about exploring the consequences and their longing for each other. And that's really what the crux of the love story is, because it's very is not fleshed out the least in the book, right, except in the appendices.
So,
I remember just watching that special feature thing that I was watching earlier. I mean, they're saying how, you know, they really don't spend any time next to each other.
Oh, no.
You know, I mean, they have to do all this time, like, when they're together in, like, flashbacks and stuff like that.
Yeah. One of the things that was a huge debate when it leaked onto the web was the fact that they were originally going to put Arwen at Helm's Deep.
Right. Which I think would have been a little insane.
Yeah, it was wisely... It was wisely changed.
I just think it feels forced.
I mean, that's just not hot.
But, I mean, that's... And this is a beautiful piece Howard Shore wrote called Evenstar, which is just absolutely amazing. But that's really what this love story boils down for me is. It's basically the longing between these two characters for each other, and basically looking, sort of exploring their thoughts as far as the consequences of this romance. It's sort of like Romeo and Juliet. It's kind of like Romeo and Juliet.
I think it's what Lucas was trying to do with Anakin and Padme, but was
that's more Romeo and Juliet than anything. This is like, you know, Romeo and Juliet as if it all happened in their head. Just if you could go inside those characters' head and see what their contemplations about this relationship. That's what I take from it. Is it the greatest love story ever told? No. That's quite frankly Casablanca, if it's anything.
Right.
But, why? Anyway. Why?
It's called sarcasm.
No, that's actually truth. But as far as the movies are concerned, at least. But, I mean, that's what I take from this story. I mean, I think for what they had to start out with, they did a really damn good job of doing it. Admittedly, here's where it sort of actually, Return of the King actually feels a little more forced in terms of the love story between these two.
Here it actually works pretty well.
Yeah.
It does. I mean, I think this is the movie that it works the most in.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in Fellowship, you don't know where these two characters are coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, in Return of the King, it's barely touched on, if at all. You know, in this movie, it's, you know, at least you know where these characters are coming from. You know what the conflict is, and you know what's keeping them apart. And, you know, this is definitely the movie that the love story works the most in.
Yeah.
But, we'll go into why Return of the King doesn't work, you know, or I will at least, you know, I mean, when we talk about that movie, but...
Yeah, you're on your own on that one.
I know I am.
Let's
just go straight to Return of the King, because I have so much to say about that, but...
Oh, don't worry, the 4-hour version will be coming out soon enough. Actually, not soon enough, but anyway, and I will say, in defense of this love story, it's like Liv Tyler really, you know, it for as vague a characterization as it is,
right,
she does make it memorable. Mm. And same with Viggo for Aragorn and his half of that. This is a great fight action sequence coming up.
It's not even in the book, is it?
No, it isn't.
No. Which I kind of start... I start to...
When actually, wargs aren't in the book at all, are they? I mean, I know they're in The Hobbit.
Right.
And, I mean, they're mentioned in the appendices, I believe, but... I mean, you don't see any wargs in the book, in the story arc, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't remember so.
But no, this is really... This is really a well-done sequence.
And it was pretty much pieced together by the skin of the filmmaker's teeth, from what I can find.
I mean, yeah,
it was really more or less slapped together at the last minute.
Yeah, because, there are so many different elements. I mean, you have to do the horse, you know, the Rohirrim and all that stuff. You have to do the orcs. You have to figure out, you know, where you're going to place the camera and stuff.
Well,
there are some pretty wild camera angles.
Well, no, I'm talking about not as much that as much as I am just the fact that this sequence was originally supposed to take place in Edoras.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. And that was actually a good change that they did it there. That they didn't do it there, I should say. I've never really been a fan of the shaky camera and that little bit there.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
I
think it could add to some of the chaos in the scene.
Well, I mean, it works in a lot of cases, but works like, you know, just look like they get still.
He's my boy.
Right. I mean, you know,
CG boy is more like it. I mean, I think his cool factor went down considerably when they mentioned on the DVD.
Oh, no, but that was the thing. Do you remember being absolutely blown away by that shot, though?
Oh, I remember there being cheers in the
and being absolutely convinced that that was real.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
No one doubted it, but it's like... Yeah.
No, I like the element of the hand, of the handheld.
I like it when it's done well. I mean, in those cases where they just can't seem to get it still, you know, where it's like, it really looks like somebody's running with the camera and not real. That's why I don't like. I love it when people use handheld as well as it can be used. Example was include Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan, which use a lot of both of which use a lot of handheld. But, no, I mean, I'm all for handheld, but it really gives an immediacy to it all, but... There's stuff, I mean, I'm just looking at some of the corners of the screen and there's stuff that I just have never noticed before. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this movie quite a few times.
Well, there was
saying something.
I never noticed that one dude's head jink being chopped off at the very beginning of the, of the sequence. I never noticed that until...
That might have been added for, like, the extended edition. It's like, you know... Because they couldn't necessarily get away with it on the theatrical.
I'm surprised that Return of the King got away with half the stuff it did for the theatrical version, but that's something.
But then again, it's become one of the most second highest grossing movie in the world, the Titanic. So it's like, mm-hmm. I don't think too many people are gonna argue that.
Yeah, again, something we can go into when we talk about the movie.
We're really trying to steer clear of the subject, honest. Now, this part is definitely not in the book. The entire warg scene isn't in the book, so naturally the Aragorn over the cliff is definitely not in the book.
Well, that is something I definitely remember around the time of the release of the second film talking to everyone who was familiar with the book, mm-hmm. you know, and how incredibly different the two were.
Yeah, this has the most changes of the three movies. As far as faithfulness to the book, I would say Return of the King is the most faithful, Fellowship second, and then Two Towers is definitely the least faithful. But at the same time, I think it really, and we'll get into this later, it's like it really took a few times watching this movie for me to really appreciate some of those changes.
I mean, just some things just wouldn't work.
Yeah.
You know, as they are in the book.
Well, it goes vice versa, too. Right. Stuff that's in the book works well on the page wouldn't necessarily work in the movie. Right. And the example that is
Frodo's
Scouring
Age.
Of the Shire,
right.
Just, it works beautifully on the page. It just wouldn't have worked in the film.
Right. Well, I was gonna keep us away from Return of the King by, you know, I was going to say, you know, that Frodo's Age would be another thing, because he's like 50 years old in the book.
But that's because of the fact that 17 years passes by. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that would not have worked from the book, mm-hmm. is the fact that 17 years pass from the time that Gandalf leaves to find out about the ring to he comes back and Frodo leaves. Mm-hmm. So it's like...
And then never truly address, you know, how long it's been, really, I don't think. In the movie.
In the movie, they do at the very, very end, in Return of the King, because they say, like, 13 months after, today after that.
But, I mean, you don't quite get it till that point. Yeah. It's kind of okay.
Yeah, it does. And the thing is, it's like, one of the things you do find about the book, though, is that you do have a very specific timeline as to, you know, this is so many, because they tell you in, like, the first couple paragraphs, it's like, this is a couple of days or so after the breaking of the fellowship and stuff like that. And then in the appendices, there's an entire timeline going through practically the entire history of Middle-earth up until the breaking of the Fellowship of the Ring. Eowyn is definitely the best written female character in the series, in the book, and in the movie. But then again, she's only like, I mean, her and Arwen are basically it.
Well, and well, Galadriel.
Yeah. I just remember about that. Oh, yeah.
And I like, I really do like how this was handled.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody's, you know, I mean, just the way she handles it in particular.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a really interesting side, as a interesting side note of Miranda Otto discussing in the cast commentary how, and Bernard Hill as well, you know, they're all saying how, they're all talking about how they filmed that moment, I think, like, months before they even knew exactly what the reason, you know, they lost Aragorn was. Which was...
Yeah, you don't get that plane too close. Applicability. That's the word that I was trying to think of earlier when we're talking about allegory and Tolkien's just like allegory versus applicability.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you remember, did you ever see in any of the extras, Brian, Peter Jackson going to like a soccer game and recording, recording the crowd doing his black speech?
I had heard about that before. When they did the special, when they were Entertainment Weekly, right before they added the special sneak preview to the end of Fellowship, they were talking about some of the things to look out for in it, and then we were talking about scenes from Helm's Deep. They did mention that he went to a soccer game and recorded the crowd for the crowd for Uruk-hai.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun to see some of the footage from that.
One of the things that they mentioned in that special Peter thing was, I guess Christopher Lee was talking about how, you know, the voice of Saruman was, you know, what really conveyed the power,
mm-hmm.
you know, behind it. And they did a comparison to Hitler and stuff like that. And I thought that was very interesting. And I thought that was, you know, very poignant as far as movies are concerned.
Thinking about that, that's what triggered me as to what the word was I was trying to think of earlier.
Yeah. Metal and wheels.
Mm-hmm.
Because the environment is good and industrialism is bad.
I buy it from Treebeard. I buy the dialogue coming from Treebeard.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Those. it makes sense.
It does.
I always think that, and they also mentioned this in the social features thing, but I always think that guys who are writers that have been through some type of war,
yeah,
even Robert Jordan, you know, Vietnam and everything, have a sort of a different telling of the story when they start talking about, you know, fight scenes and battle scenes.
Mm-hmm.
They always concentrate on the build-up. They always concentrate on the scale of the armies. And sometimes they may even skip the actual battle or do it, you know, or do it flashbacking like that, you know, but that's like the least important part.
Yeah.
You know, it's always about the
which is actually
and after.
Well, I mean, along those lines, you know, I think George Lucas based Star Wars on being a child of Vietnam. You know, and his experiences of watching it unfold in front of him
on TV. And you can especially see that in the Star of the Clone Wars on Episode 2.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was thinking about that watching it. I know I mentioned on that commentary, it's like some of those shots really remind me of stuff that I've seen, like in Vietnam films and stuff like that.
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, they mentioned special features, how J.R.R. Tolkien was in the Battle of the Somme in World War One, C.S. Lewis was in World War One, and what kind of effect that did have on the writing. And no, I mean, I definitely see where they're coming from on that. With Tyler's Arwen, Hugo Weaving as Elrond.
Are they doing anything special with her? Because she always looks like she's glowing. I mean, I guess there's a light, but I think
I'm sure there are some sort of lighting effects on there, but.
Right. And she always looks like she's glowing.
Yeah.
She's hot, but
how could Elrond not approve of her falling in love with Aragorn? I mean, come on.
I mean, yeah.
He's going a bit overboard on it. I mean, yeah, she'll lose her immortality and all that stuff. He's a nice guy.
I'm sure he's not thinking along those lines.
Yeah, I know.
I
just had to say
it. Hilarious.
I love
I'm not saying I'm not going to talk about how beautiful this sequence is. But I think this is along the lines of why he doesn't want them to be together.
I know why he doesn't want them to be together. I mean, I just had to say
because
it was funny.
Because I mean this is sort of referenced in the book.
In the appendices.
In the appendices.
Yeah. And, I remember them talking about that.
And, putting it right here, I mean, this is just not really a
real... Oh, my God. I mean, you know, the reprise of the Evenstar piece,
I heard so many...
This is just so spellbinding.
I heard so many complaints from lesser, you know, I mean, this is the only term I can come up with at the moment. But just a lesser movie watcher, I listened to so many complaints of how this movie would just speed up and slow down, and you know, and I'm like, but you know, it never slowed down until it came to a point where it should have.
Right. Yeah.
Or later on, during Helm's Deep, you know, the Helm's Deep stuff versus the End stuff, you know.
Well, it's...
I'm not complaining.
Oh, I know. But, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, I mean, I would pose the question to them, okay, well, how would you do it? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you suggest doing that? You know, it's like, because, I mean... Like I was saying, it's like these aren't even the storylines aren't intertwined in the writing of the book. I mean, they're set as separate storylines.
This is one of my favorite, by the way. I mean, speaking of spins put on original themes established in the Fellowship.
Yeah, the Rivendell theme.
The spin put on the Rivendell theme here is absolutely gorgeous. But yeah, I mean, that makes absolute sense, you know. I mean,
yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I didn't want to get into this until we got to Helm's Deep, but, you know, I listened to something in the extras that made a heck of a lot of sense about the idea of, you know, do you want to do just straight action all the way through, or aren't you concerned about the moviegoer getting quote unquote battle fatigue? You know,
yeah,
which made much sense.
Yeah, and the thing about that is, it's like, I mean, I think if there were two movies in terms of the battles that had the most influence on this movie, I would have to imagine that those movies are Braveheart and Saving Private Ryan.
Right.
Both of which more or less set the standard as far as battlefield endurance tests. Especially Saving Private Ryan, where the first half hour is more or less won the battle D-Day. It's like, but I mean, you know, and the thing is, if those movies teach you, and Saving Private Ryan especially, if that movie teaches you anything, it's that it is so hard to sit through. I mean, you don't want to numb the audience to the violence.
Right.
And it's a director like a Spielberg or Peter Jackson to know that, I mean, you have to have the human element in there. And you have to know when to go to something else.
We just experienced something very similar to that when we were watching Passion of the Christ. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, how much of that can you take without just absolutely doing, you know, just walking up and walking out of theater? You know, I mean, just.
Well, I mean, the thing is, though, it's like, yeah, some people can't take it, and you know. You can't
necessarily... For good reason.
Yeah, and there's a good reason for that, and, you know, you have to be a great filmmaker, you have to be an imaginative filmmaker to be able to make that work, and you really have to know what you're doing in order to, you know, where you keep your personal vision of what the film wants to be, but at the same time you don't alienate the audience.
Right.
And it's a very delicate line to walk. Here's a little bit of exposition. In case you haven't been paying attention for the first 2 hours.
Well, you know, I mean, as far as, you know, exposition being done in an interesting way and exposition being done in an uninteresting way, you know, it's, I mean, first of all, you know, you have the element of the map, which is just always cool. I mean, you can never, I mean, they never went wrong when, you know, I mean, when in doubt, just put a map in there. And it just...
I'm sure plenty of people were in doubt.
So yeah.
Go ahead and put that map in there.
And yeah, the thing is, it's like I always, especially when it comes
because
to...
Because that's such a great...
Geography point. Is a really important thing to establish in movies.
And that's such a great way of connecting the movies to the books.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
because, I mean, when you're in the book, you're always referencing back to that map.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only time in the movie they verbally acknowledge the fact that Samwise Sam is Frodo's gardener.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
This was a tremendous change from the book Faramir.
Yeah.
And I'll admit, this is one of the things that really had me nervous because when I was reading the early reviews, they were telling about how drastic this change was. I'm like, oh god, And yeah, I remember coming out of the movie. I mean, I loved the movie, but at the same time, I was really thrown aback by this.
Right. I mean, bits and pieces of this, you know, are sort of in the book, kind of sort of.
Yeah. I mean,
you know, he does sit them down and talk in a cave. You know.
But then he lets, you know, and you have the Forbidden Pool with Gollum, and then,
yeah.
But, you know, then he finds out the mission, and he lets him go.
Yeah, right.
So you don't have this whole conflict, and it really took watching this movie a couple of times more to really appreciate what they were trying to do, what they did with this, and achieved, which was... really adding to the suspense of and the power of the ring.
So
some new footage here.
Not just about.
No, well, a moment and a half ago, you know, just some of the dialogue.
Some
of the dialogue is different.
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little bit, though.
A little bit, but, you know.
But, yeah, you do see all the flashbacks, and this was something I remember him talking about, seeing the boat wash up on the riverbank and his brother and stuff like that. Probably the most elaborate new scene in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Right here.
And here we have Gondor.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is still Osgiliath.
Osgiliath.
But, I mean, it's in the country of Gondor. Yes. But.
This is not a bad speech.
No.
What movie was that? Matrix Reloaded. Interested in engaging speeches.
See, I was trying to avoid all Matrix talk on this one, which is why I didn't mention anything with Hugo Reaving.
Gotcha.
But, Nice reintroduction of the Gondor theme, which we don't really hear too much, but gets a thorough workout in Return of the King. And as I believe Elijah Wood mentioned in the commentary, this is the first time a new character is been introduced in a director's cut on video, which is the character of Denethor, played by John Noble.
Well, I can see why this was, you know, this is expedited out of the theatrical version, because this is all stuff that's explored really thoroughly in the third movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, like we were talking about with the Smeagol flashback, you know, yeah, it was wisely excluded from the theatrical, but it is actually vital for the extended edition because of the fact that it gives you more of an explanation as to why Faramir does what he does. Why the change in Faramir's character from the book had to happen. And, plus it's nice to see Sean Bean again as Faramir, because he did really do a good job. And
he did.
Made quite an impression from the first one.
Well, I like that this is before anything that happens in the first movie.
Yeah,
I think that's a really neat idea. Is that
Well, plus, it's really interesting. One of the things I've thought about when it comes to the scene is the fact that, you know, Faramir has this whole arc in the second and third movie, and it's like, Boromir is what, his brother's what influences his decisions really in the second movie, and his father's what influences his decisions in the third movie, and to see them, to see how important in their own way those relationships he has to those two people in this one scene really adds something of his character.
It's a nice moment. It's not, the dialogue isn't too corny or anything like
no.
that. You know, it's not, it's, I think it's, you know, it's very true to life to how, you know, that kind of family dynamic, you know,
mm-hmm.
the father and the two brothers would, I think it's very true to life.
Right. The two brothers kind of talking on one level, kind of, you know. But then, you know,
like,
fucking slightly crazy.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I mean, yeah. The brothers are communicating on that level. The brothers often do communicate on is
right.
You know, just like very few. You know, just being. You know, they're not speaking.
Yeah.
They're not saying a lot, but what they do say speaks volumes.
Well, I can't remember where I heard. I think I heard on the cast commentary. Have sort of an untold backstory to the fact that their mother died during the birth of Faramir,
mm-hmm.
and that's part of the reason that Denethor always had resentment towards him. I think I remember that. I think that was in one of the commentaries. The Forbidden Pool sequence right now, which is pretty much how it is in the book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
the singing. No, wait,
yeah.
Is the singing in there?
I don't.
Or is there some
singing? Let me see.
So this is where the biggest departure from the, or one of the bigger departures.
No, it's not. The singing's not
in there.
No.
This is where Faramir in the book, Faramir lets them go.
Not yet. Quite, yeah. I mean, it is after they capture Gollum,
right.
But it's after, you know, he's found out about the ring and
right.
their mission and all that. I mean, the only part this sequence of this whole thing with Frodo and Faramir that is not in the book at all is him taking them to Osgiliath.
Right.
That whole part is not, and him deciding the ring's going to go with the Gondor. That's not in the book.
Right.
For the most part, though, it's very much as it is in the book.
Pretty gut-wrenching.
Yeah. Again, I mean, we were talking about with the motion capture and the animation and stuff like that. There's an intimacy to the interaction in some of this that you just would not get just by doing it through animation. You have to have a certain degree of motion capture to make it work.
Unless
your animators
were, like, extraordinarily spectacular.
Yeah.
Better tools than they have now.
Uh-huh. which we're probably not far off the way Weta worked on this. And actually, I think I remember one of the motion capture studios they used was like Giant Studios, which I think is in Atlanta, actually. I think I remember hearing that. I'm sure it's in the credits somewhere.
Which I'm sure we're going to be talking well into.
Oh, I'm sure we are too. I don't know, the way we've been going here, it's like we've had a lot of dead spots as far... Not too long, but still. I don't know if that last part needed to be in here, but...
Yeah, I'm going to be at the screen.
The my precious, definitely, but... Yeah,
the screen. And mm-hmm. I thought something was going back to his...
Dollar mess qualities.
Yeah. Another little bit that was wisely removed from this was there was originally, I guess, going to be a vision of Faramir seeing Frodo as if he had, you know, how Frodo would look as Gollum. Which is basic, you know, Faramir will have seen this vision of what Frodo would turn into if he had the ring as long as Gollum did. There's kind of some cool... It's a cool idea, but it was wisely taken out. Because you don't really need it because of Elijah Wood.
Well, there's some neat stuff in the DVD of Elijah Wood being made up for that shot. But yeah, I agree. I mean, that was wisely taken out. The farmer seems to have some of the most romantic-sounding dialogue, it almost seems as if. And again, it could have been something that could have been really corny. And unintentionally funny. But he seems to speak in sonnets and...
Well, it's all the conviction of the performance. And... You know, I mean, there's not false character, there's not false performance in this entire trilogy. Yeah. I mean, not just this movie, this entire trilogy.
Love the use of sound effects right there. Dave, you got anything to say while me and Brian are over here eating sugar cookies?
Yeah.
I like, I don't know, for some reason, if you want, you know, you watch an actor on screen and you almost, sometimes you want to compare him to somebody that, you know, who has the same kind of quality, and for some reason I always think of, when I think of Viggo Mortensen, especially in these movies, I always think of George Clooney. I don't know how random that sounds.
Very random.
But
I can, I mean,
but no, it's like
how exactly are you, give me a little bit of context, because I could, I'm thinking of this working, I'm thinking of Clooney in like Three Kings and Ocean's 11, and well, I can't really see it.
No, I'm talking about the personality, not in the acting style, but like the personality that the actor conveys, as if like, you know, both actors are like, okay, I'll be a movie star. You know, it's like, sure, why not? You know,
I don't know.
They both kind of like fall into the.
If I were to make that sort of comparison, just off the top, random, thinking about Pierce Brosnan would probably be a better example for me. But,
well, I'm a pretty big Clooney fan, so.
And you haven't seen Solaris?
I haven't.
I don't know how we got on that subject, but.
Because you let me talk?
Yeah, that's right. I remember.
You should know by now, you don't.
Who was it? Mark Ordesky, one of the executive producers? Or was it Barry Osborne who said they really got a lot of mileage out of that Even Star?
Mm-hmm.
Going back to
Hero Shot.
As if he's the man.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
Going back a little bit to the horse that sort of picks Aragorn up and takes him to Helm's Deep. A friend of mine at work thought at one point that was actually Bill the Pony, and I'm like, which I mean,
oh,
I could kind
I mean,
of.
Okay.
Well, that was before the extended edition, so I mean, I kind of bought it,
right.
And then you see the extended edition, and no, it's not. It's actually the horse. It's actually Théoden's horse.
Right.
So.
That's kind of like, I mean, Théoden's arrogance here is kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is kind of the arrogance of kings.
Yeah. But, you know, he's like.
Authentic, but not cliche.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Laughable, but not laughable. Now, I mean, what just amazes me is that this is a lot of this was done with a miniature.
Yeah.
A lot of the extras are computer generated.
Or actually, bigature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, do they have an actual miniature, literally speaking, in this entire trilogy? I mean, because their miniatures are pretty damn big.
Well, now, what's that footage of Peter Jackson standing next to the Helm's Deep bigature and some of that footage that he shot for Miramax when it was originally just going to be two movies, and he was showing on videotape the Helm's Deep miniature, and it was like it was bigger than he was.
Yeah.
I was like,
exact. Well, it's like I was saying, I don't think there's an actual miniature in the entire trilogy. Yeah, because, I mean, they build them pretty big. And you have to.
You were saying?
Yeah.
I'm just strong performance after strong performance. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody is giving super spectacular performance except for maybe Ian McKellen, of course. But I mean, all the performances are so strong, it's hard for one person to stand out, you know?
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, it's like I have always really, you know, I'll especially go into this on Return of the King. I really have felt like Elijah Wood, in particular, has been really not given quite the credit he deserves for what he did with Frodo in these movies.
I mean, some people, I've read some reviews where some people just really didn't like him. Yeah.
Which
kind of baffles me. Cause, I mean,
I know.
It's hard to, I mean, you know, because I think he played off at the sort of the transition. You know, trying to hold off, but still, you know, kind of losing battle with the ring.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, he made that sort of transition real, you know.
Yeah, and the thing you have to remember is this is a single narrative spread over three films.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, the character may not necessarily change within each film, but the character will change from film to film,
right,
if that distinction makes any sense. I wanted to mention it before when we were talking about Treebeard, but I really like the beard that's made out of, like, moss and twigs and stuff like that. I just really like that detail.
Well, those are all based on Alan Lee designs, are they not?
I would be surprised if they weren't.
And John Howell is more responsible for the armor and the battle gear and whatnot. Alan Lee had a lot more to do with, like, the character kind of sort of creature design work, which that was neat to see him get an Oscar for Return of the King.
Yeah, it really was. Really beautiful theme for Eowyn. Not really given a whole lot of credit.
It's not that well established in the theatrical version, is it?
No, it isn't. But you really hear it a lot in Return of the King. It's just really beautiful. Please tell me you're getting the signals, Aragorn. I mean, she's just putting it right out there.
It's kind of obvious.
Yeah. Which is, I think, precisely why he's sort of...
That's Elijah Wood's sister. Right there.
Really?
Yes. You know that?
I forgot that. I think I...
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure they mentioned it in the commentary, but... Yeah.
I love this matte painting right here.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Trying to think of what that reminds me of.
And then
it's got to be some movie that reminds me of that. But.
Oh, man, that sucks. That's love.
Well, we're coming up on one of my favorite. I mean, my absolute favorite moment in the movie of, you know, just the idea of what's done here to.
And they made every single one of those. I mean,
these are seeing too many winters. This is what where I was kind of afraid during when I was first watching this in the theater of, you know, Legolas saying, "Look at them, they're afraid. They need an uplifting speech right now." You know, and I was like so dead in the water, afraid of Aragorn just coming up, standing up on a bench or a table or something, and just giving them all a rousing speech, which unfortunately we get in Return of the King. But
we'll talk about that on Return of the King. I've got my own thoughts on that.
But I was so glad that they didn't do that, and they just kept it really organic and really, really believable.
We both acknowledge... I love the fact that we both acknowledge we love Return of the King, but it's the most polarizing movie we've got to talk about since Spider-Man. That's what I love about that.
But you know, it's the scene between Aragorn and the boy coming up feels so much more, you know, more
just say it.
Real. Just less force. You know, and just.
Oh, I thought you were going to say your second favorite word.
Oh, my second favorite.
Organic.
It just feels more
organic. Organic. You know what you're saying.
I think we have a vague idea. Sorry, Ron.
Yeah, but like, well, okay, no, it's all right. I'm just as guilty of going off on pointless rants as you guys are accusing me of. But, and this is a beautiful, so powerful.
Mm-hmm. in the poem, yeah, in the poem, which is an inscription at Helm's Deep. Am I right on that?
I'm not sure.
I think so.
How did it come to this? Okay, so I'm just now remembering how in the theatrical version, how it goes from Théoden saying, how did it come to this, to Aragorn just suiting up for the battle. And
yeah.
And I like how it goes back to Merry and Pippin and Treebeard now.
The Ent moot, yeah.
Yeah. How they're talking about how they just finished saying this morning.
Yeah. You really don't get a huge sense as far as what the Ent moot is. I mean, you kind of get an idea as far as in the theatrical, but they really make it closer to the book in the extended version.
Excuse me.
Okay, now, I mean, this is for Dave in particular, but, I mean, you can answer to Ron, but Dave, like myself, has read the book. Would you not agree with the fact that we really get the sense of Aragorn accepting his responsibility as the, you know, as the heir to the throne? Do you think, as I do, that you get more of the sense of that realization in Two Towers than you do in Return of the King?
Oh yeah, most definitely. Yeah, I mean, he's
and it is at this moment in Helm's Deep because of the fact that I remember just tearing through the chapter on Helm's Deep because of the fact that it was such an enthralling read, and this moment coming up where he unsheaths his sword for the fight. I believe he unsheaths Narsil, if I'm not mistaken.
Really?
I think.
What, the sword that's broken in
half?
Yeah. Well, no, in the I mean, again, I'm not familiar with the books, as familiar with the books as you guys are. Well, I'm not familiar with the period, but according to the Fellowship of the Ring commentary with Peter Jackson, he says that moment in the Prancing Pony when the hobbits get on him and he takes out the broken sword right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, does he not?
No, I mean, you are right in that. You are right. Yeah. But, I mean, here I believe in the book, he unsheaths the Reforged.
The Reforged sword.
Sure. Oh!
That's what I was getting at. And that's what I'm trying to find here. And I could have sworn it was...
There's no orc horn.
This much was not in the book, but
no, but actually, we're